Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com. If we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are much important, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. this could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you'll get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Redford for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit Your remedy is inthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, thank you so very, very much, Martin. I appreciate your time and disclaimer there. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're going to do some housekeeping first, real quickly, and then I'd like to read to you two different quotes and as a foundation to what Brother John will be sharing with us tonight. So the first part of housekeeping is we have two first-time callers tonight. One is from Simi Valley, California, with a phone number ending in 3400. Would you be so kind as to just introduce yourself with a first name, please, only? Just a first name?
This is Tony.
Tony. Welcome, Tony.
Yeah, you may know me as Clarence.
Okay. Would you prefer Clarence or Tony?
Either one. I'm fine.
Just not late for dinner, right?
Yeah.
All right. One second here. Let me refresh. My board decided to give me a little headache here. No, I got to fix it. And update that. All right. Next is Anniston, Alabama, ending in 8049, if I may have just your first name only, please.
Richard.
Give me a second. It's not. There we go. Go ahead.
Richard.
Thank you, Richard. Welcome to the call.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And last is, but not least, is where did it go? Well, my goodness, they must have hung up, got scared of being asked. That's okay. All right, so let's talk about tonight first. I'm going to give you two quotations. You should probably remember them when you hear it. Article 1, Section 10, Clause 2, quote, "No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of marque and reprisal, coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts, pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts, or grant any title of nobility." So we want to emphasize the part where it says, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. And then the second quote is from the United States Code, 12 U.S.C. Section 411. Issuance to reserve banks, nature of obligation, and redemption. Now, this is often called the banking site, Title 12 is often called the banking site. And it goes into different things about the Federal Reserve, the Board of Directors, and so forth and so on. We're not going to belay that. Point being is that one is constitutional, the first one I quoted you, and the second one is unique to the United States. Where do we find the United States? We find the United States at Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, a separate entity, a separate jurisdiction. So I hope what I've shared tonight is a decent foundation to now bring before us here, Brother John.
Well, thank you very much, Martin and Michael, for that kind and gracious introductions. Tonight's topic is the value of real money. And some of the points that Brother Michael was making there about the United States, there's a difference between the United States and the several states, or the aggregate states, and that the United States speaks directly to the corporation that is doing business for the government of the United States. And when it's dealing with the corporate law, it's dealing with that specific corporation. And one thing that's very important to remember is that there are different statutes that apply to the corporation rather than the aggregate. And I should, when I talk about aggregate, I'm talking about, you know, the dirt and water and salt of the earth, soil, and the living, breathing individuals that inhabit that particular parcel. And to that end, the United States likes to, by default, coin that everybody would be a member of the United States. However, there are three definitions for what a citizen or an individual is, found in three separate places in statutes that identify that there is a unique and specific difference. However, when the corporation itself does all of its business in accounting and does all of its record keeping, it classifies everyone as a member of the aggregate corporation, not the aggregate states. And the corporation that's doing business for the United States, after the United States, there was a teeny bit of a financial turbulence back in 1929, with which that was precipitated intentionally by propping up the market by individuals that had more money than they really needed. They had enough that they could keep themselves warm at night with 10s and 20s and a little Coleman cook stove by their bed if they wanted to. And what they did was they invested in the market, and we all remember the term the Roaring Twenties. And what happened was that to that end, they wanted to find another way to control this, what they considered a potential monster out of control. And I'm taking that directly from a letter that was written before to one, from one individual to another before this meeting that occurred at a resort on the East Coast called Jekyll Island. And for those of you who would like to know more about that particular event, there's a gentleman named G. Edward Griffin that wrote a book called The Creature from Jekyll Island, and he's speaking of the Federal Reserve Bank. And what happens is that there these people that manage the money, or that the families, and some of it's called the old Roman families, or there's you know, there's a lot of other terms for it. There are the IH-13, and don't use that term too proudly. People who know what you're talking about will pay, shall we say, a little more unnecessary attention to you than you may want. And the ones who don't know what you're talking about will probably laugh and scoff at, you know, saying you don't know what you're talking about. But those are the families that maintain the finances many, many years before, and that their management of money many years earlier, and I say many, back going back to old Roman times, and that's why it's, some of it's called the old Roman blood or old Roman money, is that they found that by doing a little bit of transacting and business on the high seas and internationally, and they were able to make a few extra nickels, or maybe even a shiny dime or a shiny shekel, or a denarii at that time. And what happened is they began to help the work their way into the Roman finances. And the way they did this was that the emperors, they enjoyed being all but worshipped as a god, and the lifestyle that went with that. And when the Roman taxation didn't cover their lifestyle that they were less than comfortable with, these families beset a plan to begin to subsidize their lifestyle, and began loaning them money, and began loaning it to them liberally, and it was a loan. And we all have heard the term note or bill. Both of those are debt instruments, and they began to create notes on these loans, and they began to bill them on these debts. They began to bill them interest, and so they didn't press the fact that they need to be repaid too quickly. After they began to work themselves into the financial structure of Rome, they began to work themselves in the financial structure of Spain, and slowly, the king of Spain began to loan Spain money. And eventually, they began to amass a huge amount of debt with notes and bills, and at a certain agreed to interest rate. And eventually, anytime one of these countries made a fiscal overture to the other country, there were either pack mule trains or horse trains or ships that would go from one port to the other carrying not just a few hundred pounds of heavy metal, but tons of heavy metal. And sometimes these ships would flounder in rough seas, and a large portion of the GNP, gross national product of that country, the GNP, would sink to the bottom of the sea. And so there was a lot of risk. When they would send it by a horse or pack mule train, they always used to have to send a very strong contingency of their army, their armed individuals. And to that end, their armed troops sometimes would be waylaid by ruffians. And the gold or the heavy metal would be sacked and taken from them. And sometimes all of these individuals were killed. And so transacting huge huge fiscal amounts had some risk. And to that end, these money families, and I'm not going to admit that they may have been some of the ones that were precipitating the attack on some of these envoys, groups that were trying to pay debts or do fiscal trade, but that they precipitated a case where the kings were very, very concerned about the security of their funds. I'm not going to imply that for one second, or may have even sank three vessels in less than 1 year, that the equivalent of would now be rated as over 309 metric tons of heavy metal. But I'm not going to state that. What we are going to share is that what they began to do was go to the kings of these nations and say, hey, look, that nation over there has a substantial debt to us. I tell you what, how about if we'll just wipe away some of your debt in favor of what they owe us, or we'll consider the transaction you owe us a lot, and they're supposed to be sending this to you. How about if we, we'll just lower your debt, the amount that they're supposed to send to us, and we'll just increase theirs on the books. And so what happened was is that the first trading of debt instruments that were not entities with intrinsic value, meaning gold or silver coin, began to occur. And to that end, eventually, so that they could transact large quantities of fiscal activity, they began to write notes of surety. And they would send a letter that had was signed that had the debt that constituted a debt instrument, but that from that the envoy from one country could take to another saying, hey, look, just touch base with these people. You need your money. You want it in coin or you want it in heavy metal. Check with these folks. They'll deliver it. And they, in most of these cases, they started with Rome, Spain, Greece, a lot of the Mediterranean countries. And what happened was is that after not just, you know, 50 or 100 years, but after 8 and 12 years of doing these transactions slowly, it became worldwide renowned, these money families. And they began to transact quite regularly, and they would write these equivalent of an IOU, and which was a monetary instrument. And the only reason the IOU had a became a valid monetary instrument was it had a wet signed signature on it. Sometimes people look at our U.S. notes, oh, that's right, or the dollar bill, and they say, well, what makes this a monetary instrument? Well, if you pull one out and look at it, you'll see on either side of the likeness on the front, there are two signatures. Those signatures make it a valid monetary instrument. Without those signatures, that's like when you issue an IOU to somebody for, say, three apples, and they look at you and scratch their head and says, what's this? He says, that's my IOU for three apples, but there's no signature on it. Oh, excuse me. The moment you sign that, it becomes a valid IOU, a valid transactable monetary instrument for three apples. And then that person wanting three oranges from another vendor says, hey, I don't have any cash today. Would you consider accepting this IOU that is signed by that person over there or this other person that you may have heard of and for three apples, and so I can get three oranges from you? And all of a sudden, these IOUs begin to be traded. And it, eventually, when we find ourselves coming to the France and England in the days as Roman has begun to slide a little bit and is not the quite the empire that it used to be, and the same with Spain, we see them beginning to print money and denominations that made it easier to carry rather than having a pocket full of 5 pounds or 3 pounds of heavy metal or substantially more than that. They've got it in a paper note or a cloth note that they try to hide within their clothing, et cetera, et cetera. And early on, the ruffians didn't know about some of these notes right away, and they only looked for the heavy metal. And sometimes if somebody had a note rolled up inside their clothing, the ruffians didn't get it when they would be searched for the coin. And so it became very desirable to some individuals to go after these notes and bills that were what many of us remember, and most of us still remember what silver certificates and gold certificates were in this country, and that they you could turn that in for that value of heavy metal at any treasury department. And but in 1933, the U.S. on a situation where some foreign and domestic investors had propped up the market, declare and then pulled their money out so that there was less value in the market than they actually had money in the banks that were left in the banks. They pulled their money out of the banks so the banks didn't have enough money to pay off, because they carefully and strategically placed a lot of their money in the banks here in the U.S. so that they were, and they, we called it the Roaring Twenties. And in the stock market crash of 1929, they had pulled their money out, some of it up to 3 weeks ahead of time. So the banks were already very brittle. And then when they sold their stocks on the exchange, so that now, people, the other money that was there was now in their, these guys' hands, and that nobody could buy or pay off their stocks, etc. They went to the banks to try to draw money out, and there was not enough money left in the bank, and the banks closed. And then we have the stock market crash of 1929. And as a result of that, the U.S., quote-unquote, precipitated by these individuals, declared bankruptcy. And to, quote-unquote, stabilize the economy, they the U.S. government began to seize all of the heavy metal, the gold and silver. And what happened was that they began to tell everyone that because we're desperately trying to stabilize the economy, we have to make certain that this gold doesn't go offshore, that we have it to stand behind the currency or the notes or bills that we're issuing. And that was their, that was their story. Your Honor, that's my perjury, and I've got witnesses, I mean, my testimony, and I got witnesses to stand by it, you know, to support it. And that's what they did. And what happened was that something they didn't tell individuals was that the value of that currency in the weight of the heavy metal could now, because the heavy metal was not out there, could be changed or raised or lowered at their convenience, at the convenience of the money families and the money changers. So what happened was that they only had X amount of gold. Every time the U.S. government passes a funding bill that they can't cover fiscally, they were printing, if they only had $10 in their kitty, they now had an additional $10 worth of spending to do, they printed the money so that $10 of gold, you know, and the $10 bills that were already issued were now worth only half the gold that they had in storage, because now they had $20 to that $10 worth of gold. And so what happened was that subsequent acts of Congress and subsequent congressional sessions, and remember, when I say Congress, we're talking about the House, because all the funding and spending bills occur in the House. And so what happened is, by the way, that just might be why, one of the reasons why the House race was so important during this last election, because it does control the funding and the spending. So what happens is that slowly the value of the dollar began to depreciate as they inflated the amount of currency that was in circulation against the gold that they had in Fort Knox and at 110 West Wall Street. And most people don't know that 110 West Wall Street has 7.5 times as much gold is in, actually is in Fort Knox. And that we actually, the Federal Reserve there actually keeps gold for other countries. And that the others, these other countries, they're issued instruments of credit against the gold that they have there so that they can do transactions and lines of credit or LOCs or SBLOCs, standby letter of credit. And they, their collateral is the gold that is, not, and it's not just that one particular bank. There's quite a few banks around the U.S., like 110 West Wall Street, the Treasury Department there. But what happens is that now the money that you have, we've all heard about what inflation occurred like the middle of last decade or last century, like Argentina and other places, and like is currently occurring like in Zimbabwe, where they have $10 trillion notes that will barely buy something to eat at the fast food vendors there in Zimbabwe because their money is inflated so bad against the little intrinsic value heavy metal that they have that the inflation has gotten out of control. The government, to pay its bills, was allowed to spend out of control. This is one of the reasons why spending currently is so dangerous here in the U.S. Now, the gold coinage is still out there and is allowed to be used for transactions, and which it brings up a and silver coinage is still there, and silver, gold, and silver coins are still being minted, and the ones that used to be minted back in the turn of the last century and this, you know, this century, and they talk about the $20 gold pieces, you know, the double eagles and the St. Gaudens and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, there's an interesting note about that. See, that is a valid U.S. currency. And some people say, well, John, you can't use that to go buy a car. And I say, well, I might beg to differ. Well, what dealership is going to accept gold or silver for a transaction? Well, good question. I'm glad you asked. You know, and back in 1993, we had somebody that wanted to buy a brand new Dodge Viper. Back then, it was $87,000. And so what happened was, is, you know, the dealership here in Houston, the Dodge dealership was, you know, they even went even up to the owner of the dealership, the family, the father and the two sons there, says, no, we can't deal with it. I says, well, I tell you what, how about if we have some special interest in doing the transaction in gold, but how about if we had somebody arrange in a completely separate transaction, not anything to do with this one, but I have somebody that really wants to buy this gold from me, but I was thinking I wanted to hang on to it to do this transaction for my car or the car I'd like to buy from you. Would you consider making an arrangement to sell it to them? And he says, well, how much are we going to get paid? Well, it's the kind of funny. The amount of gold that we have here is exactly the price that you're asking for at the car, for the value of the heavy metal and some numismatic value. They says, well, before we would want to engage in that, we want a certification of those. And we provided it, and they agreed. So what happened was is that for – is everybody ready for the amount of $120 and one in U.S. currency, one of the $20 gold pieces was valued at – $62,000. It was a uncirculated, never been touched by human hands, double eagle, $20 gold piece, and it so the numismatic value was $62,000. But back then, the other $20 gold pieces were going the regular weight of the ounce. Well, actually, two of the others were numismatics also. But for $120, and so the lady started to fill out the paperwork, you know, for $87,000. I think it was like $820. And she says, no. We're purchasing it for $120. And by this time, this lady's object. She says, that's no. We got to pay taxes and et cetera. Only on real money we're going to pay taxes, ma'am, sales tax. He says, well, no, hold on. She called the county assessor collector, and this gentleman is a close personal friend of mine, and he sent somebody over, and she says, no, I want to know what the value of that is. You can't. And I says, ladies, could we, the lady at the dealership and the lady from the assessor collector's from Paul's office, I says, I've got a friend. I'd like to ask, can I use your speakerphone, ma'am? And she's, sure. So I called the federal prosecutor's office, and I got Ann on the line. And I says, Ann, what is the penalty and what is the statute for identifying a different value for an existing U.S. currency face value? And Ann said to her, says, well, that's a second-degree federal felony. She said, and then she kind of spilled the beans, because I introduced myself as Mr. Fiala. She says, well, John, do I need to send somebody over there to detain somebody? You know, and so she kind of spilled the beans, you know, that she knew me, knew who I was. And luckily that didn't turn problematic there. But all of a sudden, the lady from Paul's office and the clerk at the dealership and both the father and both sons says, no, we'll accept it. I says, can I get back to Ann on this one? We may or may not need it, you know. And luckily when I called in, I had to go through three separate people to get to Ann, the federal prosecutor at the time. And so they were fully convinced. They didn't need any convincing that we were really talking to the federal prosecutor's office, you know, and the attorney general's office. And so they filled this out, and the sale price on the face value of the coinage was $120. And by this time, Paul showed up, the assessor collector for Harris County. And he said, John, what are you doing here? You know, and he led on to everybody that we knew each other. We sit in committee together at the Republican State Convention and such. But you know, and explained everything, and he started laughing after everybody else told the story. I said, well, here, let them tell you. Everybody else told the whole thing, and I didn't say a word. And Paul just started laughing. He says, you know, you are going to be totally a pain in my ice. You realize how much flack I'm going to catch if I let, you know, this. I says, well, Paul, do you have a choice? He says, that's just it. I don't. And so I was told that when that Dodge Viper sold 7 years ago, that they were still paying taxes. The annual registration taxes on it were now they were paying tax on $120. And that they were paying the minimum for the registration fees. What happened was is that the first owner, we also asked them for the manufacturer statement of origin, the MSO, and we never registered. The first owner never registered it. However, when it was sold the first time, the second owner did not understand everything that Jerry had done and why it was so important. And he went ahead and registered it with the state. And the third time it was sold 12 years ago, they were still only paying taxes on $120. But the value of using real money to make transactions, there's something that's kind of unique and very good there. There is a little subdivision in upstate New York that there were 14 homes in. Gated community. This is circa 1978, 1979. And back then, the most expensive of the homes was $22 million, and the poverty-stricken poor two houses were only $8.5 million in circa 1970s money. And what happened was that this gentleman commented that his annual tax bill, property tax, was just over $1 million a year. Well, what happened was is that we came in. I had some friends that this one particular friend resided in Oceanside, California, that and he's the one that we borrowed the numismatic coin from, and he charges back then he was only charging a 4% usury fee as long as everything was done in less than 10 days, and that was in addition to the security detail and the PD. The protective detail that he demanded and required went with the coinage. We went and transacted at a title company. First, the house that was just over 22 and the one that was right at 22, 5 weeks apart. And the title company gave us the same thing that we ended up would later end up with this dealership out here. Well, no, that's not the real value of that coin in this. This face value. See, they're $20 gold pieces, you know. And the $22 million house, after we got through everything with the federal prosecutor's office and, you know, convinced them, and they had the local sheriff show up and try to arrest us for fraud. And when the federal prosecutor, the sheriff showed up, while the federal prosecutor was on the phone, and back then it was a he, and that I was speaking with, and I let them talk with the sheriff, and all of a sudden the sheriff, which now, from the time the first one entered in, and the sheriff deputy, and he called his watch commander, now there was over 20 of the sheriff deputies out in the parking lot, et cetera. This was very, very serious, the fraud. They were going to arrest everybody involved. And a person at the title company called, a secretary did. But we ended up with a good laugh, and everybody left famous friends, and they were paying taxes on $1,640 for this $22.5 million house that previously he was paying over $1 million a year in property tax. Okay. And this was after a stack load of exemptions, you know, and discounts, etc. He would have normally been paying close to $2 million had he had to pay the going rate. Okay. The next thing we did was the one that was valued right at 22, about 5 weeks later, sold. Now, we did three more in the next 5 months, and the gentleman that we were borrowing the gold from, he had, at this juncture, he had now made over $1 million worth of usury fees, that's what we call it, for borrowing the gold, and we had a total of five people that were willing to pay him an extra $50,000 or $100,000 a piece. And I didn't realize that two of them actually had sent him a personal check, one of them for $50,000, and that's why I say, and one of them for $100,000, just saying thank you at when the taxes were due. And so what happened was is that over the next year, we transacted three more for a total of eight of the 14. The other six says, hey, look, based on the comps, we want our rate adjusted. In that particular jurisdiction, it's ad valorem tax, and the comps qualify under the state law as potential sales. And so what happened was is that this was one of the, it was, they said it was the third wealthiest neighborhood per capita in that whole, in all of that section of the state. And they were all paying less tax on less than $1,700 per property after 3 years. And it took almost 22 years before the ad valorem taxes got the annual taxes up over $5,000 per property, based on what their, you know, the maximum cap rate, et cetera, et cetera. But the families, they started a little pool and a little kitty themselves, and collected enough gold that they were able to do the transactions, and they paid the closing costs and did these things at regular, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And eventually, we had most of them put into corp souls, and a couple of them into charitable religious trusts, so that eventually they weren't required to pay any property tax at all. We were able to do something really neat and really good with using real money. Presently, you know, some people say, well, John, that's, you know, even though it might have actually happened, it's still a pipe dream. Well, using real money, I have an Ace Hardware store here that is less than 6 miles from my house as the mole flies. And I walk in there, and this guy whips out his smartphone and looks up what the daily spot price for gold and silver are. He says, John, you got any silver, any gold? You know, and I've been taking the 1 ounce gold or silver coins and been doing business with him for almost 30 years. And there used to be another place called Food Town. They closed their doors. The owners closed the doors a while back because it wasn't doing that well. But the store managers and one of the three owners, when I came in, they would gravitate to me and say, "Hey, John, you got any heavy metal?" You know, and they'd look it up. But sometimes we'd go to the office and they'd say, "Hey, look, I tell you what, how about if we just transact the metal you want to spend today at to the regular price of Ferns, the Federal Reserve notes, and just get it over with right now so that you don't have to take it to my cashier." Yeah, that's fine. And so what happened was, is at least once a month, I made a point of walking into that supermarket and taking at least one, if not two, silver coins with me. And some months I would go in there two or three times, you know, when the interest was starting to wane, and when one of the owners changed, I went in there, and the new owner, the new partner, which was the grandson of the one that had passed away, he was, "Oh, this is BS," and the other owners, they says, "No, it's not." And that grandson, we became famous friends. And one time I walked in there with two 10th-ounce gold coins, and I got as good a rate. You know, if I go to the HGX, Houston Gold Exchange, or there's a few others here, you know, they always charge you 2%, spot minus 2 or spot minus 4% or something to do the transacting, you know. And, well, you go into, and there may be some other food establishments, some restaurants, and, other hardware stores where I go in, and they give me that daily spot price, and it's better than I could get at the Houston Gold Exchange. And so it's 23 skidoo. And oh, by the way, when it comes to some of the times, and I used to ask Kyle, I says, "Kyle, look, I don't really want to pay sales tax. You know, I'm going to buy $300 to $400 worth of groceries today." And, you know, understandably, you know, that's, you know, that's like, you know, 30 some odd dollars or $40 worth of taxes. But could we, you know, work this? Would it be okay if we work this at the register? You know, and one time when I had two 10th-ounce gold pieces, you know, I was going in there. I was, we were cooking for a wedding And my wife and I were had agreed to do the cooking, and so I was buying a few groceries, and he just laughed and he says, "You when you get ready to check out, you get a hold of me." And he still used to invite me to the office every time I come in and say, "Hey, let's transact in advance." But if I was going to do some big purchases, they did it for face value of the coinage, and he would stand there personally and make certain that I only paid sales tax on the coinage that I was providing to him. About 10 years ago, there was a fire and it spread to our place and took our place. And we lived inside of a metal building, and the steel in some cases got so hot that it wasn't just softened and it wasn't just melted, but it was incinerated. The fire got so hot. But the thing that was really shocking was that, and we may have had a little bit of paper currency or cloth currency ferns stashed in different places, and some of that survived, very little of it, but some of it did. But the thing that was really, really fascinating was that almost all the heavy metals survived. And after the fire, that's what we used to go buy building materials and things to, you know, and tools and stuff to start cleaning up the mess. The insurance company didn't cover one drop. They got out of the whole thing. When the fire marshal found out that the insurance company wasn't paid, he had gotten up to $5.8 million on our place because in Harris County, where I live, most of the insurance companies, any loss over $100,000, they expect a fire marshal's report on it so that they know what they're actually paying for or not, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the equivalent of their certified report. They may send some investigator out to look at, but that fire marshal's report, that is gold. That's E.F. Hutton talking. You know that old commercial about when E.F. Hutton talks, ever the world listens. It was interesting, and it saved a lot of grace. If I was to suggest to anyone that having or keeping some heavy metal or some precious metals around, you know, whether it's silver or gold or whatever it is, I couldn't encourage you more strongly to do that, especially right now when we're coming into a time when there's a conspiracy to try to put our female friend in the front office and go to digital currency. And although our uncle has been a little bit reluctant to sign that, a lot of it reluctant, there are people right now that are considering him another potential JFK issue. And those of you who remember JFK, he didn't get dead because of some nuclear missiles 90 miles south of south and east of one of our border states. He didn't get dead because he may have been sleeping with the same girl that was sleeping with the world's most powerful mob boss at the time, and that she wouldn't identify who the father of her unborn child that she was pregnant with was. That wasn't what got JFK dead. It was the fact that he signed the U.S. Note Act of 1963, that he was going to restore us to the gold standard, put us back on the, and if, you know, within 3 hours and 27 minutes of being sworn into office, his successor, the first thing he did was repeal that U.S. Note Act, that so that we would not go back on the gold standard, and that the paper money. And everybody probably remembers that 1964 was the last year that silver was coined in quarters and half dollars, et cetera, and dimes. And that halfway through 1964, some of them were only half silver, or actually 40%. But the real money. And there are people that when I get a chance, I go buy rolls of silver dimes for them or silver quarters, the old ones, and I use them regularly. And I, you know, and I tell them, I got a roll of silver quarters here. We can break it open. It's $10, you know, but they give me the value of the weight and they charge me the tax because I've slowly nursed this into that situation so that the taxation is only on the value of the real money. With that, we could go on like many of the other topics. We have the honor and the privilege of cussing and discussing on this call. I could continue to go on. My time has now come to a close. We're going to open up for Q&A now. If you can keep the Q&A to the subject matter topic, that would be pleasant. If you're unable to, or you have something that's pressing significantly, a question on another topic, you're free to ask that, okay? With that, I'll turn you back to Martin and back to Michael.
Well, thank you so very much, Brother John. Thank you so very much. You know the routine, everyone. Press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Press star 2. And when you do that, your name and phone number pop up to the very top of the board, and then I can unmute you and you can ask your question or make your comment. For those of you listening on Freedom's Radio, look to the center right of your monitor. You will see a box where you can type in your comment or your question. Underneath that box, you'll see a place to put your name, some other information. Hit submit. And when you hit submit, it pops up on my end, and I'll be happy to lend my voice to your comment or question. While we're waiting for the board to populate with people doing what? Pressing star 2 on their keypad for their comment or question. I want to introduce a gentleman to you that is prayerfully post-event. Now, those of you that follow me on other channels know exactly what I refer to when I say post-event. It's a GCR. Prayerfully, he will be coming aboard with us, participating in a certain aspect. In the meantime, I'd like to go ahead and open up his microphone. Let me unmute for a moment. There we go. And ask Bo to say hello, introduce himself, take a minute, maybe 2 minutes, and talk about what he does and where he'll be with us sometime in the future, prayerfully. Go ahead, Bo.
Hey, Michael. Am I on?
Yeah, you're on.
Good evening, Bo.
I wasn't expecting to.
I know you weren't, but listen, you were kind enough to share this call tonight with your people in your organization. I'm very appreciative of that. I'd like to introduce you to my organization. So just give a little shout out to them and tell them a little bit what you do, and we'll go from there.
Wonderful. Well, we have a significant group of people, and we're focused on addressing the aspect of affordable housing. Thanks to lovely hyperinflation that was explained a little bit by John there of real money versus using.
Is there a TV or a radio going on in the background? Somebody's I'm hearing a lot of crosstalk. I'm having trouble understanding you, Bo.
Yeah, there's no background noise on my line.
Okay, go ahead. Please continue, Bo.
So our goal is affordable housing, and we are moving forward on actually building homes with steel framing instead of 2x4s, and so now you have a significantly more powerful structure as far as your home, and at the same time, instead of $300 a square foot, we're as low as $90 a square foot, so we're one-third the cost with a superior product, and they're... I'm sure many of you are aware of the suppressed technology. We are using innovative technology to generate all the food, the water, the power from within the home so that when the storm passes, your house remains standing and you got food, water, and power so you can survive after the storm when the shelves are empty and the power is down. So that's what we're doing across the country, and a byproduct, we're going to start to address the 600,000 people living on the streets of America. And we've got a fascinating way to actually get them back productive in society. So that's what we're doing as good patriots for America.
Super, super. And ladies and gentlemen, wow. if you'd like to see a direct application of that, go to AmericansRestoringAmerica.com, and you'll see a place that says a tab underneath the header that says humanitarian is what it says. Click on that, and you'll see the regenerative villages that I hope to enter Bo to join me in building across the nation post-event, post-RV. So until then, thank you, Bo. Appreciate your comments. And again, that's AmericansRestoringAmerica.com. Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for sharing.
Thanks for joining us, Bo. Appreciate you.
Yeah. All right. So let's start with Brad in Crystal River, Florida. I've been there. That's a beautiful little town. Go ahead, Brad.
Hey, yeah, I'm actually in Ocala.
Okay.
But the phone was the phone was purchased in
there.
But last night we talked, and I asked about Styles manuals. So I would like to get one, and I was wondering, is there one that any of you guys would recommend?
What was
John,
the question again about which manuals?
Style.
Well, like a Chicago Styles manual or an American Styles manual. There's various ones. I'm just wondering what would be a good one, a good starter Styles manual.
Okay.
I sent you a text on that.
Okay. What is your goal, Brad?
I'm not sure how to say that. I'm trying to learn everything that I can, and I keep coming up against information about how to do certain things. Like, for one, I've signed your name. That was one of the old ones. And there's all other kinds of legal filings and so forth, and how to do paperwork, and they always reference the Styles manual. And I would be very interested to see what they're referencing and just have one available.
Okay,
I recommended to me in the past to get one of those if I was going to begin to study law.
Right. That and the Style manual in law, the thing that is the biggest issue, you know, in law is this is what they call the style. That's that header on any pleading that has the starts with the case number at the top and then the parties and the judge and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there is a Styles manual and has a 40,000 foot overview of all of those issues and that directly relate to the legal side of it and what's going to happen now. There's one that's available on the internet in a PDF form that literally as we speak I'm preparing to send Michael the link to it. And I'm just going to put this under Brad's name, okay, Michael?
Yeah, that's fine. I'll forward it to him as soon as I have it.
Okay. Yeah. And that way, for those of you who don't understand what a Styles manual is, it's everything. It talks, there are Styles manuals that apply to setting up an organization. There's Styles manuals that reference how you buy or sell or borrow material. And it even talks about the form, the way you format it, your paragraph, your font, you know, and size and everything. But the Styles manuals directly relate on how to format and record information, and it's a standardized method. And what happens is that if you are making a legal filing and you have not followed or adhered to the style, at least roughly, sometimes your pleadings get turned back to you. And theoretically, that's illegal. That's a deprivation of rights under color of policy that they want, or law in certain, like in Louisiana and Wisconsin, Alabama, the law is very strict about the style. And if you don't comply with it, the clerk won't even accept it. That means that a person who's not legally skilled and background in jurisprudence, they don't have the right to have they're depriving their right to have their case heard because the style, meaning the format and the beginning of the pleading, is not met. So, Brad, now let's see here.
Brad's already got it. I've already sent it to him.
Okay, Brad. Did you get your fan mail yet? Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, just give that PDF there. This is the place to start. Okay.
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 That answers the question. Thank you. I have one.
Is there anything else? Is there anything else we can do to be an asset or blessing for you?
Yes. Today I was visited by a mutual friend. I think I can say his name. Chet West.
Okay.
And he had a thumb drive that he gave me full of a lot of his writings and some of his cases and so forth. As I was perusing that, when I got the passport and the passport card, I wasn't really sure why I was getting both or what one was used for and what the other one would be used for. I mean, I knew the regular passport would be like international travel. But he suggests for anybody reading his materials that they go through your program, and he mentioned, you know, the passport would be for international travel, and then he said the card kind of takes the place of a driver's license and other licenses like fishing license if you were asked to provide those.
Correct.
I never heard from you guys any directions like how to use the card.
Brad, can I make some interjections there?
Yes.
First of all, we're gonna role play for the next 90 to 120 seconds, and you're gonna be the judge, and I'm gonna be a defendant charged with no state driver's license. Okay.
Okay.
You ready? Okay, good. As the judge, you know, you'd read the thing, State versus John, you're being charged with no state driver's license. How do you plead? Your Honor, I have a question. No, John, this is, Mr. John, this is not the trial. It's a pleading. Guilty, not guilty, or nulla contendere. Your Honor, I have a question. This isn't a trial. You know, what don't you understand? I said, don't you understand why you're here? No, I don't, Your Honor. Well, explain that to me. What are you, mentally incompetent or something? Your Honor, is the court aware of 18 U.S.C. 242, deprivation of rights under color of law? And sometimes they say yes, sometimes they say no. I says, can I provide the court with a copy of that. What we're saying is that if I don't have this state driver's license, that I can't go to work on Monday or church on Sunday or go shopping on Wednesday night, or if my son on Tuesday afternoon cuts his foot on a glass bottle, that I cannot use the car to drive to the emergency room to save his life. Is that what we're saying? Would the honorable court consider that deprivation of rights under color of law? What happens is that every single time I've got it dismissed, every single time. And, I was broadsided. Somebody Friday, I had I'm not going to call her an undocumented alien. She had a Mexican passport with still 9 weeks left on her visa, and she broadsided me T-boned me in the driver's door of the vehicle I was driving. And she hit me going over 30 miles an hour. And she was accelerating when she hit me. And I called 911, had the officers there. We got the vehicles cleared off the side before they got there. And the officer says, well, I need your driver's license and your insurance certificate. And I said, I've already exchanged insurance with her, but she doesn't speak any English. And he says, well, how do you know that? And I says, well, I talked to her. I mean, hablo poquito español, you know, and he says, well, I'm going to have to get a translator because I can't use you, you know. And he got a translator there, but let me see what I've got for what I drive on. And I says, well, here's some ID for you if you need it. And I show him the passport card. And he says, well, I need what you drive on, you know. And I says, I'll see how quickly I can find that for you. Things got a little tossed around topsy-turvy. And he, after about 20 minutes, came back and explained to me that she was claiming diplomatic status and a reciprocity agreement. So he guy says, "Are you?" And she had no insurance. Well, it was expired 2.5 months ago. And he's under a reciprocity agreement that they can drive without a Texas driver's license here. And that he was just going to give her a warning. And he says, but you already know that, don't you? I says, well, I'll bite. What do you mean by you already know that? He says, you know, I can't give you a ticket for anything because your registration is over 3 weeks out of date and on this car. And I says, really, is it? And I pulled out and I showed him the sticker. It just hadn't been put on. And he goes, oh, I guess not. He says, you have no Texas driver's license, and you've been here more than 6 months by the law. And I asked him those very questions. I says, you know what, if you feel so inclined, go ahead and write me a ticket. It's my honor and privilege to accept a ticket for whatever charge you want to write. He says, are you for real? I says, I'll just go explain to the judge, you know. And he says, what do you mean? I says, you know. And I says, you know, right now, Judge Cagle's standing in for Judge Vincent right now, you know. And he goes, how do you know that? I says, I'm not admitting that I know Jack personally, okay? He looked at me. He says, well, you already knew that I couldn't write you a ticket for that anyway. And he hands me back my passport card, you know, and because I seemed a little bit baffled where what I drove on was. I says, I found what I drive on. He says, well, here, let's see it. And I showed him an International Motors Qualification, IMQ. He says, well, I've never heard of this. And he says, but even if I never heard of this, I can't write you a ticket, can I? I says, well, you know, you spend a lot of time on the phone over there. What did they tell you? He says, you know, they told me I couldn't write you a ticket. You know, but he took the passport card, ran it through his scanner, swiped it on his PDT there, the portable data terminal, and talked to his watch commander, and they pushed it up the hill, and he came back. He says, I apologize for any inconvenience that this is created for you, sir. You know, and he says, I hope it's okay with you that I'm not citing her. And I says, well, you know, I'm sure your report will reflect who was at fault. And citation shouldn't be necessary, should it? And Constable Logan looked at me and he says, thank you. He says, you know, I says, you almost sound relieved. He says, I am. He says, because they told me that if you said you were going to press charges, that I had to cite her, even though she has diplomatic status, which meant that she would have had to have been, we have 48 hours to extradite her back to her own country, you know. He says, you're a... And I says, you know, and I just smiled. And I didn't tell him that I'd never heard that before, and I didn't know that. But it was very, very interesting. And I may have been stopped quite a couple of times for traffic infractions. One of them, I was doing a 83 and a 55. At least I was certain it was a 55. Turns out it was a 45, but I was going flow of traffic. And I, you know, the officer, I made sure that when I pulled got pulled over that I had all the windows open. I had my wallet already out, and I had my State Department plastic card out, and I had my insurance out. And when I came to a stop, I took the keys out of ignition and tossed them up in the dash in the front part of the windshield, and I had my hands at 10 and 2 on the steering wheel. And he come up, and he, you know, he says, may I have your driver's license and insurance? I says, I was looking for what I drive on before we came to a complete stop. I need to look for it real quick. But here's my insurance, and here's some ID. It's a federal ID. He says, well, I need your driver's license. And I says, well, and I says, here, let me look. And I start, and I've got one of those wallets that's got about 30 or 40 cards in it, and they're all stacked together. And I'm, you know, and I accidentally spilled some of them. And he goes, well, here, let me see your passport card there. And so he went back to his thing there. I was verifiably non-belligerent. Keys were way up there in the dash in the windshield where I couldn't, you know, all of a sudden move the vehicle. The car was, the engine was off. You know, the windows were all open so he could see everything and he could see, you know. And he was back there about 20 minutes. And he comes back and he says, I don't need what you drive on. He says, sir, you know why I stopped you? I says, no, actually. He says, you were doing an 83 in a 45. I says, no, this is a 55 zone. And, no, it's a 45, you know, I says, well, my humble apologies, please forgive me, but if you, you know, feel so, you know, I'm honored to accept whatever ticket you choose to write for me. He goes, well, he says, you know, I can't write you a ticket. And, I says, and I just kind of smiled, and he says, tell me the truth. Is there a problem? I says, well, yeah, there was. The gauge on my dash went out just to, you know, I was out driving and all of a sudden I looked down and I don't have any more gauge. My whole instrument cluster went blank. And he goes, oh, okay. Well, he says, try to drive a little slower if you can. He says, and he had already told me that before I told him what happened with the gauges. He says, here's your ID and your insurance. He says, hey, you have a nice day. And once again, I apologize for the disruption in stopping you. He apologized to me. I was so shocked. And lately, Brad, I've been learning new things about the State Department ID. And I'll tell you, we've been doing passports and doing this for many, many years. Passports and passport cards, and I learn more all the time. I wish I could say I know exactly the ins and outs and what these. To this day, I have not had a chance to ask the officer what they're looking at, you know, and why they come back almost apologetic for stopping me. And Brad, there's I've had the people say, well, here. Take a look at this. I'm going to give you this before I give you my driver's license. Whoa, holy kitty litter, Batman. That's just inviting a tiff, and they don't even – and every time somebody has said that, I found out that even though the officer had the capacity, they haven't looked at it. It's just you don't want to give me your driver's license on demand. It was part of the contract for getting your driver's license. You're required to, because you accepted the driver's license, show it to any law enforcement official. And in some cases, they've arrested the individual. And some of the individuals have held off on giving it because they just wanted to make a point. And, you know, they had a tack on their chair. They wanted to prove that officer that they were somebody special. Whoa, holy broken tree feathers, Batman. Don't do that. You know, that's way wrong. You know, be the most kind, pleasant citizen that they ever had the honor and privilege of interfacing with. And remember, they work for you. This is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. That is one of your employees there.
Yeah, John, let me answer what you're talking about here as well, because there's a lot of people on this call tonight that have no clue what this dialogue exchange has been about. For those of you that are on the phone call tonight or on Freedom's Radio, having listening on Freedom's Radio, same phone number, same PIN, same time, but tomorrow, but last night, Monday night, every Monday night, we have calls regarding your political citizenship status and how to correct that from a 14th Amendment federal citizen to a citizen of one of the several states united in perpetual union. Cross versus Board of Supervisors. This is 1966. It says, quote, both before and after the 14th Amendment to the federal Constitution, it has not been necessary for a person to be a citizen of the United States in order to be a citizen of his state, which, of course, is citing Cruikshank, U.S. versus Cruikshank from the 1860s or something like that. The other thing regarding relating to traffic issues or licensing issues, this is W.W. Cargill Company versus the state of Minnesota. This is a little bit older. It's 1901. It says, quote, the acceptance of a license in whatever form will not impose upon the licensee an obligation to respect or to comply with any provision of the statute or with the regulations prescribed that are repugnant to the Constitution of the United States, end quote. So, you know, these are the things that you carry with you or that we start teaching you. It's all, everything that we have under the umbrella of your remedy is in the law.com or AmericansRestoringAmerica.com is about teaching. You're the student. We have seven or eight different teachers that focus on different things. And every night of the week, Monday through Saturday, we're teaching on one relevant subject or another. So I just encourage you to visit freedomsradio.com, where you'll see the calendar set up on who's talking about what that night, and then join us preferably on the phone with a PIN number, and we'll be glad to share that with you. The other thing, too, it'd be most important, and write this down if you have something to write with, www.AmericanByBirth.com. Go to that website. You'll see two PDFs underneath the header, streaming. The first one says, once we were colonists subject to a king, a primer on jurisdiction. Read that PDF. It's 21, 22 pages. And what it amounts to is it's taking several, maybe 50 different court cases, and by presenting them in an orderly fashion, much like connecting the dots, if you would, with verbiage in between, we walk you through your rights as an American national, as a citizen of your state versus being a federal citizen. And then the second PDF underneath that's quite lengthy. It's a little booklet. It teaches you how we came from where we first originated under the Articles of Confederation from the War of Independence to where we are today. What was put into the law, if you would, that they rely upon, often in error, I might add, because they're unconstitutional. They're unconstitutionally operating. But it shows you how we went from the beginning to where we are today. And it's not a pleasant journey, but it's one that you need to know and understand. So thank you so much. Back to you, John. Back to you, Brad.
Okay, thank you. I think I've taken enough time tonight. But I really appreciate the fellowship and the leads. So thank you.
You're welcome very much. And next is Tony out of Damascus. is that Iraq?
Iraq? Actually, Tony out of Maryland. Damascus is the area code, semi-area code. Okay. That I might live in Urbana, Imesville.
That's all right. It's all right.
That thing.
Just say hello, Tony.
Oh, don't worry. Don't worry, Tony. We'll pray for you.
Tony,
may we be an answer or blessing for you, Tony?
Tony's calling in tonight because he has a special situation going on.
I've been to Damascus incident, the real Damascus, a long time ago, but that's a different story. So I just received yesterday a not-so-friendly letter from IRS stating that my documents were frivolous from March 22. So I'm in a situation where I want to know what's the proper response in regards to status and things like that, and that's why I'm calling. The situation was that, so that you have the bigger picture, David Strait documents were used originally, and then I contracted with you guys to try to do some corrections, and we resubmitted documents, but you know, this letter did appear, so I'm calling to discuss, or not so much discuss online, but who do I talk with in your group to revisit this subject and get my status changed properly?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, you're talking to the point of the spear when you talk to John. John, real quickly, Tony has gone through and corrected his political citizenship status. I was the one that helped him with that process. So he's good to go on GW's program.
Now, does he have, is that corrected with or without an SSN?
With.
Okay, thank you. Continue on, please.
No, that was it. When he communicated with me earlier today, I wrote back kind of an admonishment, if you would, that he should have never have had any communication with the IRS without having spoken to the team to begin with, but that's water under the bridge. Let's go from there.
Let's make an appointment for Tony in the next 24 to 48 hours to take a quick look at this. Tony, can you, if you haven't already scanned your fan mail into an electronic document yet, could you please scan that and forward that to Michael? And what we'll do is we'll take a look at it, and then we want to schedule an appointment to huddle and have some chat. And we and depending on how things look, you know, we may get one or more other information providers also on the conference call, so that we can see if we can do what it takes to be an asset or a blessing for you, my honored brother.
Very good. And fan mail I'm talking about is the documents originally submitted, correct?
All of it.
We want all of it. We want the fan mail that came from them and the fan mail that you sent them.
Okay. All right.
Starting with we do not find your 2017 1044 or whatever it is. I'm making those numbers up, so whatever is applicable.
Yeah, no, they actually did not come at me with a subsequent request for filings, which I was a little surprised about.
Oh, really?
But because I haven't submitted since 22.
Let's get copies of the fan mail that you have, and let's go from there.
Okay, real good. Okay. I'm sure I have an email for at Mr. Edwards.
I'll text it to you in a minute.
All right. Thank you very much. I know that's kind of often the specific packet group that people a little too deep to go to
all right.
General public.
No,
yeah.
Sure. No, Tony, let's take a look at it and let's get after it. Sick 'em doggy.
Yeah, and I'd like to discuss this publicly next week, if you don't mind, Tony. Nobody knows Tony from Adam, okay? So that's not a problem with your anonymity. And it's a great teaching tool for everyone on the call tonight to hear how this issue is dealing with you and then what is a logical response from the team. John, if you wouldn't mind, without sharing names, can you talk about the Roman Emperor and the other people that you're dealing with? These are code phrases so I can keep things anonymous. John understands who I'm talking about. And share with the people on the call tonight how you have worked very hard for the last, I guess, 18 months, 24 months, in guiding a couple of students that are parallel to each other on your endeavor in dealing with the IRS and where you've taken them from and where you're at today and where you hope to go in the future with it. Do you mind covering that real quickly?
Yeah, we could do that. And I'll start by making it very, very simple. In the Declaration of Independence, it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these, indicating it's from a larger pool of rights, among these are the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and that to ensure these rights, governments are instituted among men by the consent of the governed. Abraham Lincoln, in his November 19th, 1863, Gettysburg Address, concludes in the final sentence, says that this government should not perish, that being a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And what happens is that the Ninth Amendment says the rights herein enumerated within the Constitution are not meant to disparage those already held by the people, indicating that there is superior documentation and rights that precede and are preeminent to the Constitution. The 16th Amendment does give individuals the right within the government to exude taxes from whatever source they would. The thing that it doesn't say is accept anything that's illegal or unconstitutional. And you have the right to earn a living. And to earn that living, you know, because you have the right to buy a house, buy food, put shoes on your children, buy clothes for your bride, etc. And so among those rights, the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, you could roll right in there, and the right to earn an income. If you can tax a right to the place where you either take away that the proceeds from that right, or you can imprison somebody so as take away their liberty so that they can't exercise that right, then you have to ask yourself, is that right really a right? Or was the statute improperly imposed? And the 16th Amendment, it does have the right to make tax, but it does not say on income. And the 9th Amendment makes it very clear that anything within the Constitution cannot disparage the rights that you already have or will have. Okay? And so what's happening is that we're working with individuals. The first pursuit started in 1978, where I was working with a widow in Southern California and then a homeschool family in 79 that we had just gotten out of prison, the both parents out of prison and all seven children released from CPS. Those are the two that we started on, and for both of those, we have an agreed-to court order with the federal prosecutor and the IRS that says we agree you're not required to file a 1040. Okay. There is a lot. There's a teeny weeny bit of work that has to go into this. This is not a case situation where you're going to be able to walk in and just lock knee, step, monkey motion in 90 or 180 days or less than a year. Usually the cases carry on for more than a year alone. But there's some advanced ground footwork that we have to do with every individual. We're working with a handful of individuals at some phase through this right now. We've got many students from the past that have those agreed-to court orders, and we left famous friends in every single event. There's actually even two of them that the court order states we agree that you're not required to file a 1040, and neither you nor your descendants or their Marian spouses to perpetuity. And the only thing, the challenge that we do have right now is that all of those cases as part of the agreement are agree to order is that they're not allowed to publish or share it with anybody, that if it comes out that their order and the agreement is void. Somebody tries to tell them, look, you just came to work at my machine shop or McDonald's here. You got to file a, you know, I need a W-2 from you, and I need a socialist insecurity number. I mean, a social security number for you, a TIN. And what they do is they say, here, here's a phone number. Can you share with them your concern and ask them how you and I need to proceed? And that's the way it gets handled. And that's and right now we're at Americans Restoring America. We're starting to turn the tide by coming up with a new format that is going to allow other individuals to be able to use what we've done for either case law, or we're looking at potentially shutting down the IRS. And there's at the RSC this last year here in Texas, I was in committee where actually I've been in committees with the RSC for Texas for over 35 years or 34 years. And one of the things that when they started to go to the state income tax, I spoke at the RSC three events in a row, and that state income tax direction, directly what happened on that case, and one of the lieutenant governors that was in that case, they agreed that there would not be any state tax, and they asked me to, and we talked to the legislators that were trying to put it up directly, and convince them that there in no way, shape, or form should we ever consider that. But what happens is that they asked about the federal income tax, and they says you should be able to get that resolved and dissolved. And yes, we are currently working on that. And Michael and I are pretty much working on it pro bono. We have some students that, bless their heart, that are willing to charge up San Juan Hill all by themselves, and they are honoring us with the privilege of the pleasance of their presence and teaming up to work on their case so that we can use it for potentially everybody's case. It's not easy right now. It's a very, very expensive proposition for Michael and I, and we've spent more than a shiny nickel on it, and years worth of time getting to the place where we're at. And you know, based on the arguments that you heard just now, there's another argument based on your status that we haven't finished the brief on that one yet. I've been focusing on this other one because this is preeminent, and whether a person is a member of has membership in the citizenship of the capital, United Capital States of America, capital, all caps, or they are an aggregate citizen or an aggregate resident of one of the aggregate states, and not a citizen of the United States. This is more preeminent. We are using the citizenship status kind of as a hold card because it's still a trump card with no reference to our current incumbent 45, 47, or I mean the one that's coming into the office here. And by the way, this discussion has been made before that individual, and he is completely 100% in support of it, and asked why we hadn't talked previously on this, you know, and in our previous discussions. And so that's a 40,000 foot. I've exceeded the time that Michael allotted me to share. Back to you. Is everybody there?
Yeah, I was muted out having a nice conversation with you.
Okay.
So anyways, did you want to go into anything about the hill? Or not?
We shouldn't. We shouldn't right now.
All right. Not a problem. So, ladies and gentlemen, this has been a fight or an endeavor with different members of the team for a little bit over 40 years. Some of us are in there 30 years. Some of are like John is, I think, 40, 45 years. Some are 10, 20 years. You have men and women who have gone to law school, graduated law school, took their state bar exam, passed their state bar exam, and then when invited to become a member of their state bar, they simply said, thank you, but no thank you, and have been, for the most part, working in the capacity of having power of attorney within an organization, whether it's a limited liability company or a trust, charitable religious trust, whatever it is, for the most part. On occasion, it has become necessary for a student to exercise their Sixth Amendment, to have assistance of counsel, and to go into the court, not representing themselves, rather, presenting themselves. This is all jurisdictional stuff. You go to AmericanByBirth.com, read Once We Were Calling a Subject to a King, then follow up with The Greatest Story Never Told. You'll understand everything that I've just said, and it'll be perfectly clear. If there's no other questions, press star 2 on your keypad while I check Freedom's Radio. I'll do a refresh back there to see if anybody's asked a question there or made a comment. And then we'll say goodnight if I don't have anything else coming in. Stand by. I don't see anything on Freedom's Radio, so we'll come back here. Oh, Brad's back and Sweet Baby James. All right, so we go with Brad. Go ahead, Brad.
I'm sorry, real quick, you gave a reference to a case, something about licensing and not having an effect on
right
the licensee. Can you give me that reference?
Sure. It's W.W. Cargill Company versus State of Minnesota, or Minnesota, if you prefer, 180 U.S. 452. 180 U.S. 450. Yeah, make life easy on yourself. Go to AmericanByBirth.com. Get the first PDF. Once We Were Calling a Subject to a King. It's about a third of the way, or a good solid quarter to a third of the way through the writing. So it's about page 8 or 9
or something like that. All right. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. And then next is, I call him Sweet Baby James. Can't help but help. When you know this guy, that's all he is. Go ahead, James.
Hey, good evening to all of you. And thanks again for all you guys' information. But I do have a question. I was on the last statement, was talking about the states not having taxing. But it should be the federal government also. Am I correct? They shouldn't have no tax on federal government or the tax of state.
That is
tax, right.
You are very correct. And that's one of the things that we're currently working on here at Americans Restoring America.
Okay. Because I'm 66 now, and I'm thinking about going back to work, but I just don't want to pay any tax to these because I've been out the system actually for a little while, somewhat out of the system. And
What state do you reside in?
In Michigan.
You're domiciled in Michigan.
You're domiciled in Michigan. Yeah,
domiciled. John threw you a curve on purpose because if you are a resident in law, you're domiciled in Washington, D.C. That makes you a federal citizen subject to the United States. Having residence in one of the several states. That was a
curveball.
And you walked right in it.
Yeah, Mike. I was just trying to stay focused on what we were saying, but you guys were saying, but Mike had taught me that 100 times. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I'm on my job now.
All right. Anyways, there's something to add to what James was talking about. The easiest way is to go with the flow. It's not what you want to do necessarily, but it's what you may do to take the easier path to follow. And that is this. You heard them talk about Chet earlier. I call him Mr. Slevin, Herr Slevin. He has a limited liability company that does not, by the way it is wrought, WROUGHT, the way it's put together, does not have a tax liability or duty to report. It's a limited liability company, a commercial application that does not have a duty to report or to pay taxes. And that's because the creation of it is done through someone who, when they came into this world, was never assigned a Social Security number and never acquired a Social Security number. To this day, they do not have a Social Security number. They operate through limited liability companies. They operate through trusts. And they are a American national without having to correct their status. And because of the way it's originated, and the reason why I bring up an LLC is that all of your corporations in this country, whether you're going to work for Publix and you're going to be a bag boy, or you're going to be a greeter at Walmart, if you're that old, James is 66, so he's just good for being a greeter. Hey, welcome to Walmart. Is that they are accustomed to dealing company to company, corporation to corporation. A limited liability company, an LLC, is just another vendor to write a check to. And when you operate through a limited liability company, you're not even addressing with them the status, political citizenship status question, which for them is a red flag because they don't want any trouble from the IRS. They're more afraid of the IRS than they are of doing the right thing. And just always keep that in mind. So that's why we promote the limited liability company, which we do on Wednesday nights. Tomorrow night we'll be discussing that. Back to you, James and John.
And James, one thing to point out about that is that works regardless of which state you're domiciled in.
Correct.
You should try to visit the Wednesday night call if you can.
Will.
Okay. Well, back to you, Michael. Do we have any other? Any other questions up there?
Nope, that's the end of it. I want to thank John for joining us this evening, and I want to thank Bo as our special guest this evening. Really appreciate him showing up. And thank you all for your questions. They were great questions tonight. Tomorrow we will continue with Herr Slevin regarding a limited liability company and how it is so advantageous to you to operate through that. I've just done something myself with the programmers that we have to expand, give them the ability to expand their offerings to the general, not the general public, but the commercial community out there. So we created a new LLC just this past week, and it's called the itgarage.llc. So you've got a website, itgarage.llc, and that's so you can hire them in when their time that they don't have devoted to what I'm doing, that you can hire them to do something for you. And so that's how we operate. We operate through entities that shield you. You know, it's not against the law to avoid tax. Every time, those of you on the call that you know, every April 15th, you're dutifully filling out your 1040 form, that is a form for tax avoidance. How many children do you have? Three. What is your mortgage interest for this year? You know, whatever. And you're all those things deducted from a tax enabling you to avoid the tax. Now, there is something that's illegal. John, what's that illegal? What's illegal about tax not paying taxes?
Evasion.
Ah.
If you try to evade that is illegal. But if you avoid, that is completely legal.
There you go. All righty. So until tomorrow night, John, thank you. Until tomorrow night, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.